Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've still got another great hour with you and Dan Harris. Dan, of course, co-anchor of Nightline, weekend edition of Good Morning America, reports for 2020, world news with Diane Sawyer. It's all over the place. We'll come back in a moment. We'll take your calls and continue chatting with him about his work. 10% happier next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dan Harris with us. Dan, what's your work schedule like? You're all over the place.
It's crazy. Saturdays and Sundays, I'm up at 3:45 to anchor the weekend Good Morning America. And during the week, two or three nights a week, I anchor Nightline, and then I try to sneak in a day off, and then I'm off sometimes flying around doing stories. So it's pretty nuts.
So you're doing about 6 days a week, huh?
Minimum. But I got to say, I love this job. So it's the only downside is that, you know, sometimes I don't get to see my wife as much as I'd like, but I love the job.
I understand. Yeah. And you've got to do it. I mean, when you're hot, you're hot. You might as well take advantage of it.
You know, I am keenly aware that the thing, you know, I work in a fickle industry. The thing could go away at any moment. So I just try to enjoy it while it's, while I got it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you found some success with what you do with meditation, which helps you quite a bit, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It really has been huge. And as we've discussed, you know, helping me have the right kind of stress and not the wrong kind of stress, and not to let the unpredictability and the competition get me down more than it needs to. You know, there's a certain amount, you gotta compete, you gotta be in the game, but at the same time, it helps to realize that it's just a game.
What kind of people are practicing with meditation now, Dan, to get a little control of their lives?
Here's what's fascinating, is there is now an elite subculture of highly effective people, very surprising people, who are meditating now. So just pop off a little bit of a list to you. I'm talking about executives at companies like Aetna, Procter & Gamble, Google, Twitter, General Mills. I mean, these are the people that make Hamburger Helper. elite athletes like the Seattle Seahawks, who had a meditation coach, Novak Djokovic, the tennis star, a lot of the people who are playing in the Olympics and the World Cup. Perhaps most surprisingly, the U.S. military, including the Marines and the Army, are both spending millions of dollars to see whether meditation can make more resilient and effective warriors. You got pop stars like the lead singer of Weezer and Katy Perry and even 50 Cent and Howard Stern who are meditating. So it's really starting to take off, but it still has this PR problem where people think, a lot of regular folks, myself included until recently, think it's either baloney or impossible to do. And the truth is, it's neither.
How soon do you start seeing personal results, life-changing results?
For me, it happened pretty quickly, and there were two big ones. One is focus, which is a diminishing resource in the age of the tweet and status update and text and call and constant phone calls, et cetera, et cetera. I found that I was able, you know, by going through this routine of trying to focus on my breath and then getting lost and then having the grit to bring myself back, my ability to focus got better pretty quickly. And then the biggie is this thing, mindfulness, which we discussed in the last hour, and I'll just briefly describe it again. It's just the ability to see what's going on in your head in any given moment without getting carried away by it. And that develops, and that, you know, you start meditating and you start becoming more mindful after a while. And again, that is just such a scalable skill. It can stop you from overeating. It can stop you from losing your temper. It can stop you from ignoring people when they're trying to talk to you, all the things that get us in trouble. And it's huge. And, you know, mindfulness it's like a bonus level in your brain that nobody points out to you. We think that the only thing the mind can do is think. But in fact, the mind is capable of something else, which is to just be purely aware of stuff. Right now, for example, if you're sitting, George, you're aware of the feeling of your butt on the chair, but mm-hmm. you weren't thinking about it until I pointed it out. There is something else that you're capable of. And what mindfulness is harnessing this other capability so that you have like an inner meteorologist that is seeing the outer bands of the hurricane, the outer bands of whatever internal storm you might be about to experience before it hits land and before you get taken away by it.
The panic attack was your wake-up call. Had you not had that, what do you think would have happened to you?
I think I would have continued on as a hard-charging, you know, reasonably happy guy who probably, you know, was more stressed than he needs to be and wasn't enjoying the amazing perks and luxuries of my life to the extent that I probably should. And, you know, and I think also all of the negative health effects that go along with stress, you know, your back can hurt, you can get sick more frequently, you know, you can live shorter. And so I think there are health benefits to doing this, but I also think that it's just that I'm more awake for my actual life and I'm enjoying things more and not letting the bad things bring me down as much as I used to.
You've got a birthday coming up in July. You look forward to moving ahead and just doing what you continue to do. You basically saved your own life, Dan, by doing what you've done.
I think that may very well be true. I'll be 43 in July, and as much as I love my job, and I really do, and I continue to have pretty grand ambitions in that sphere. I mean, having the opportunity to be, for lack of a better term, an evangelist, a very improbable evangelist for mindfulness and meditation has opened up a whole new thing for me. And I feel like I'm actually doing some demonstrable good in the world. I'm really enjoying that as well.
Let's take some calls with you, Dan, for what's left of the hour. If you want to give Dan Harris a call, you've got those numbers. Plus, if you've had a panic attack, you might want to share that with us. I want to see what kind of an event you had to go through. I've got a dear friend in St. Louis, Dan. He is a professional ring announcer in his part-time moments, and he was in the middle of a ring, 1,000 people watching this series of boxing events, and he gets hit with a panic attack. He starts shaking. He's got the microphone in his hand. He starts shaking right in the middle of the ring. He feels lost, empty. He thought he was going to die of a heart attack right there. He said it was the worst experience of his life. It's horrible for people.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. It feels like you're going to die, especially if you don't know what's happening. A lot of people check themselves into the ER saying they're having a heart attack. And, you know, these things can be triggered for all sorts of reasons. And the sad fact is that once you've had a panic attack, your brain gets good at having panic attacks. And so there are ways to treat them, but, you know, it's tricky. It's super tricky. And I think about it every time I go on the air. I haven't had a panic attack since I stopped using drugs, but, you know, it's not one of those things that you erase from your mind very easily.
No, and it just kind of rolls in and rolls out. I would guess, Dan, you don't necessarily have to be on drugs to have a panic attack, right?
Oh, no. It can result from stress. It can result from lack of sleep, which is often tied to stress. It can result from trauma. It can result from all sorts of things. And, my problems were really, frankly, self-inflicted. For a lot of people, their problems are the result of things that are beyond their control. That happened in their childhood, perhaps happened to them while they were serving overseas. And I frankly have a lot more sympathy for those people than I do for myself, because I really, you know, my problems were off largely the result of just mindlessness and stupidity.
Let's go to the phones east of the Rockies. Jeremy is out there truck driving near Colorado. Hey, Jeremy, you're on that side. Go ahead.
Hi, George and Dan. How are you tonight?
We're all well. Thank you.
Good. I just wanted to ask, been curious about meditation. Is it the same thing that people get out of prayer, like religious people, when they pray to a deity? Do they get the same benefits that you would get from meditation?
You know, I think there's overlap here, but there hasn't been enough science that I'm aware of to say definitively if the same thing is happening to the brain. But I do think there's overlap here, and I think it's a really interesting thing. You know, let me just give you an example. There's a kind of meditation called compassion meditation, where you are literally it's a little sappy sounding, to be honest with you, but what you're doing is you're picturing people and sending them good vibes. And this rather sappy sounding exercise has been shown to change the brain in ways that make people people nicer, has actually been shown to grow the gray matter in areas of the brain associated with empathy and compassion. Now, I have a friend who's a pastor. He would never do this kind of meditation. And yet, he does do this thing where he walks down the streets of New York City and he tries to view everybody through the eyes of Jesus. Now, you tell me, isn't that similar? And isn't that a training of the brain and the mind in a similar way? Now, obviously, my friend the pastor would argue that what he's doing is supercharged because it's connected to God. And he may be right about that. I don't know. I'm what I think could fairly be described as an agnostic. But I think just if we look just simply at the level of the brain, I bet you would see a lot of similarities in terms of the outcome.
And even to take it a little step further with what you've done, Dan, your meditation, I think, is good for the body. I think prayer is good for the body, but I think it's dealing with a different area, though there is that overlap there. I think yours probably makes people healthier.
You know, and I think the question is, how do you pray? I have a Buddhist meditation teacher who likes to quote Mother Teresa, who she has a great quote where she says, somebody asked her, what do you do when you pray? She says, I don't talk to God, I just listen. And then somebody said, well, what is God doing? And is he talking to you? And she says, no, he's just listening too. And that sounds an awful lot like meditation, where you're closing your eyes and just seeing what happens and just watching the mind. And maybe that's watching God. Who am I to say? You know, if what you're doing in prayer is simply sitting there and listing, making a wish list, then maybe it's not similar to meditation. But I bet you there are kinds of prayer that are very similar to meditation. And by the way, just one last point on this. All the major religions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, they all have mystical traditions that explicitly involve meditation. So this isn't something foreign for our culture.
Would you say that you were negative prior to the meditation?
Negative overall as a person?
Yeah, as a person. Just, you know, you just had a negative attitude. Because I would find that difficult to believe. But I'm wondering if you carried a cloud over your head or something.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would just say I was probably more negative than I am now, but not a negative person. I certainly wasn't, you know, an unhappy.
You liked people and people liked you, right?
Yeah. And by the way, you know, I had like a blissfully happy childhood. I've had an incredibly fortunate life. It's just that something about this core diagnosis of the human condition, that we all have an inner narrator that is the central feature of our lives, that is basically out of control, that is constantly projecting forward into the future and remembering the past, constantly lurching from one hit of pleasant experience and yet never satisfied. That core diagnosis, which I think applies to the most fortunate and the least fortunate of us, hit me so powerfully and made me realize that as good as my life is, it could be better. And that is really what's driven me.
Let's go to Lynette on our wildcard line. She's in Warsaw, Kentucky. Hello, Lynette. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, darling. Can you hear me now?
We sure can.
I was diagnosed in 72, panic attacks, anxiety. I said, no. Now that I realize, it was undiagnosed allergy attacks, because every time I go to the Boone County, Grant County line on the interstate, I start, and they said, what is it about that? I said, allergies. But I was labeled anxiety and took all kinds of tranquilizers, and I said, body, I will not be your victim. Flushed them.
Well, good. That's good for you. That brings up an interesting question, Dan. How many people who are subjected to panic attacks are prescribed prescription drugs?
I think a lot of them. And I think a lot of the times those prescription drugs can actually be really good for you, but sometimes they're not. And it's really an individual thing. Everybody's brain and mind are different. And for some people, medications can literally save your life. And in some cases, medications can ruin your life.
Yeah.
and be the source of addictions. And clearly for that caller, it was a problem. But for others, it can be a real blessing.
Tim's a first-time caller in Columbus, Ohio. Tim, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
I, too, had an attack years ago at work that where I actually ran from my office basically screaming and down the steps, and I was teary and blubbery.
Oh, my God.
They sent me to a they sent me to the employee assistance program, and I got a counselor who immediately got a hold of my physician, and they were trying to prescribe me some antidepressants and things. And luckily, I am also a member of a 12-step program, and I got to talking to some of my sponsors with that program, and I turned to meditation. And over the years, I can say I've actually gotten off my blood pressure medication. I don't take any kind of drugs now at all. And I had a question also. I use music when I meditate. I was wondering if you do and if you have any recommendations.
I don't use music, but I don't think there's a problem with that. And first of all, congratulations to you. Your story is fantastic.
It's a great story.
And I love hearing it. But the word meditation is kind of like the word sports. It can describe a whole wide variety of things. And just as badminton and water polo have very little in common, I think meditation with music and meditation on the breath are quite different. But I think the outcomes can be very similar. And in your case, it clearly reduced your stress, which obviously was tied to your blood pressure and to your mental health, and I think it's fantastic that it's working.
And Stephen, if you like music, just Google search Stephen Halpern, H-A-L-P-E-R-N. He produces meditative music, which may help you. I wonder, and you come from a family of doctors, Dan, but I wonder how many doctors really understand what a panic attack is. It seems like just in the few calls we've already taken, doctors are pretty quick to prescribe something.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not sure, you know, I may be cutting against the tide in this atmosphere, what I'm about to say, but I'm not sure that's a bad thing because, again, I think there's some evidence that in certain cases, medication can help.
Yeah.
But there are other things that can help, too. For example, let me just give you an example. I haven't had a panic attack on the air since I stopped doing drugs, but I did have a mild bout of panic on a subway one day, and I went to my doctor about it, and instead of prescribing me drugs, he actually prescribed me what's called exposure therapy. He said, I want you to go down into the subway, not get on the train, but go down to the subway 3 days in a row. And then on the fourth day, I want you to get onto the subway, but then don't ride it, just step right off.
Yeah.
Do that for a couple of days, and finally I want you to ride one stop. And then, slowly after doing that for a couple of days, my fear went away. So there are lots of ways to handle panic, and if you have a good doctor, he or she will explore the options.
Well, that's I'm going to talk about one of my panic attacks. I did have one when we come back, Dan. We're almost done. Fast couple hours with you. Dan Harris with us. We'll come back and take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Dan Harris with us from ABC. Has worked 10% happier. We've got final calls here for you. Dan, I had a panic attack once. I've got to tell you about this. I had several years ago kinked my back, and the orthopedic surgeon said, look, I really can't see anything wrong. Let's get you an MRI. And I'll get some more information that way. And I went, fine, sure. So he made the appointment, and I went. And there was this machine. They didn't have quite the open donut MRIs at that time. They had the long tubed shape MRIs. And so they said, we're going to put you in there for 20 minutes. You sit here on this little movable gurney, and it pulls you in. And here's a little button. Hold it. And I said, what's this for? And they said, it's just if you need to get to the nurse, she'll come by. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, just keep it. Hold it in your hand. There's a little button on it. If you need the nurse, you squeeze it. So I go in there, and they said, all right, you'll be in here for 20 minutes. Don't move. And it's a tube that is like 2 inches from your nose when you're on your back. I mean, it's like you're in a coffin. And, I mean, I was getting the willies. You had to be in there for 20 minutes. You're not supposed to move. I'm 18 minutes in, and the nurse says, we have to do it again. You moved. And I said, I didn't move. And she said, no, you have to. So we started it all over again. And about 3 minutes into it, I'm squeezing this button because I need this nurse back. She's not there. And she comes by and says, what? And I said, I need out of this thing. And she said, no, you've got about 17 more minutes to go. And I said, I need out of this thing now. I had the worst attack. I never had had one before. And it was the worst feeling ever. And I had to get out of that tube. Is that a panic attack or is that a phobia?
Man, you tell that story so well that I almost had a panic attack. I don't know because I wasn't in your mind. I mean, it could, you know, to me, like if you were actually having a panic attack, you would have been screaming and yelling and banging on the door.
I was getting so close to that.
Yeah, I think you were close, and you know, I don't know where to draw the line between rising anxiety and fear and outright panic because I'm just not enough of an expert. But it's whatever it was, it sounded like it was not fun.
Is a panic attack a slow build, or does it just come on instantly like that?
Lots of flavors, from what I can tell. But every time I've had it, it comes on pretty fast, and it's like this vibration that you can just feel, kind of like coming up over your shoulders and floating down the front of your face, and it feels like the universe is collapsing in on you, and you just—it's this big, sudden and violent release of adrenaline, and it's the same physiological response that a caveman had when he was being chased by a mastodon.
Yeah,
you are having the fight or flight response, and it's just terrible.
Let's go to Scott in Toronto, Canada. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, Dan. Hi, George. How you doing?
Good,
man.
Sorry.
This is right up my alley. This, George, listen to that story. I think all of us that have experienced what you guys have know exactly what you're talking about. I had my first panic attack. I was living in South Florida, and I was driving a car to pick up my wife, and everything started going numb, and I started hyperventilating. I actually pulled over on the side of the road and asked people I didn't even know who the heck they were to drive me to the hospital. It was like, I can laugh at it because it's so ridiculous, but in the moment, you're freaking out. And now, unfortunately, I'm suffering depression, and that's what I'm trying to fight. And Dan, I appreciate that you've written a book about meditation. I just want to read a very quick paragraph out of something that I'm reading right now. That if you find you need a little more than meditation, maybe you don't, but those listening may consider self-hypnosis. It says that the fundamental difference between meditation and self-hypnosis is that whereas meditation helps one to detach from problems, hypnosis zeroes into the problem, examines its causes, finds a solution, and then eliminates the problem. The secret of hypnosis is focused concentration, excluding all outside interference.
What about hypnosis, Dan?
I think that this is an area where I'm a bit out of my depth, but I do think there's an overlap between hypnosis and meditation.
Yeah.
And I would just say to you that, you know, in terms of depression, you're not alone. There's no shame in it. It happens to the best of us. It's happened to... You know, there's a high correlation between depression and creativity and achievement. As I said, you're not alone, and there's no shame in it, and you can beat it. If not eradicating it completely, you can manage it effectively. And we've just seen it time and again. And there are lots of ways to go at it, from medication to meditation, which has been shown to be highly effective with depression. And if self-hypnosis is working for you, then bravo. I personally favor meditation, but I'm of the school that you should use every arrow in your quiver when it comes to a problem as important as this. And I would certainly throw sleep and exercise and diet in there as well.
Dan, I've seen a lot of successful people who make a lot of money and they're not happy. They're just not happy. Can those folks be reached?
Yeah. There used to be a sign in my favorite record store in Boston, Newbury Comics. And they used to have a sign that listed all the new releases and what dates they were coming out. And they had a little note above that that said, all dates and change, so can you. And that has always stuck with me. I had a grandfather who was a very, very difficult, unhappy man. And in his late 70s and early 80s, he decided to change, and he became a very nice man. And he learned how to type on a computer and started sending emails to all of his grandchildren, very nice, fun emails, staying in touch with all of us. He joined Twitter at the age of 88.
I love that.
And so I just think that we think that we are the way we are and that we can never change. But neuroscience would disagree. Neuroscience would say that the brain can change at any time. And the whole radical proposition of meditation is that you don't have to accept your level of happiness and your level of kindness as it is right now. That you can practice these things like a skill. They are skills that you can build and enhance just the way you can build and enhance your body in the gym. And that is an empowering and liberating notion. It also happens to be true.
My mother was born in Fitchburg, Mass. Did you ever find your way getting out that way?
I worked in local news in Boston for many, many years. I can't remember a specific story in Fitchburg, but I would be surprised if I never visited, because I did a lot of, as you know from your local news days, you're in the van covering stories all over the place.
Constantly. And my favorite news director that I worked with in Detroit ended up at WNAC in Boston, Dick Graff. Long time ago. Long time ago. That's a great news time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got it all there, because you've got all these universities, you got all these smart people, you got a lot of an international crowd coming in, but then you've got, the local population of, you got a big Irish community, you've got a big Greek community, so you've got just a big melting pot there and lots of smart, interesting people.
Elizabeth in Lehi, Utah, you are on with us, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi, good night, or good morning.
Wherever you are, go ahead.
I just have a quick question. I drove my husband 3 times to the ER with anxiety or panic attack. I don't know what it was, but it was signs like he was having a heart attack. And then the doctor said, no, he's fine, he's just having an anxiety attack. So I just need to know the difference between panic attack and anxiety attack, and it have anything to do with being a negative person.
Well, I am not a doctor and not an expert, so I'm reluctant to give you some sort of answer that would only be proven to be wrong later. But to me, it seems like the difference between anxiety is more like is a little bit less of a red alert, where with anxiety you can be very, very worried and constantly and chronically worried. Whereas with panic, you are absolutely paralyzed with fear, and your heart is racing, your lungs have seized up, and your brain is flooded with adrenaline. So that, to me, seems to be the difference. That's how I would describe it, but I could be wrong. And does it have anything to do with being a negative person? You know, maybe in some cases it does, but sometimes it can have to do with the fact that you had some sort of trauma in your early life. Sometimes it can have to do with just a pure problem, a neurological problem, a problem in your brain that's, there through no fault of your own. Our minds and brains are conditioned by all sorts of things, and I wouldn't hold him responsible for the fact that he was having an anxiety attack, but I would hold him responsible for how he handles it. Does he go and take affirmative steps to try to deal with this? Well, that's really his responsibility.
And before we take final phone calls, Dan, let's do some quick reviews here on people who have had panic attacks, some of the meditation skills and techniques that have worked for you. Could you just buzz through them again?
Sure. What I would say to people is meditation is for everybody, not just people who have had panic attacks or anxiety. It is going to be seen as the same. It's going to be in the same bucket as no-brainers like eating healthy food and exercising and brushing your teeth, because the science so strongly suggests that it can do pretty amazing things for your brain and your body, like lowering your blood pressure and boosting your immune system and changing the areas of the brain that regulate stress and well-being and kindness. So I would say to people who are interested in getting started that 5 minutes a day is enough. It doesn't need to be something you add to your to-do list that stresses you out, because that kind of defeats the purpose. And no matter how busy you are, you probably have 5 minutes to give this a shot. So how do you get started? How do you learn how to do it? Plenty of places. Google mindfulness meditation. You can find instructions on the internet. You can buy a good book. Like a friend of mine wrote a book called Real Happiness. Her name is Sharon Salzberg, and she explains in very simple secular terms how to meditate. There are meditation instructions at the back of my book as well. And you can go to a class. If you look up mindfulness meditation, if you're in a big city, the odds are there are classes in your neighborhood, or you can find a teacher on Skype. Lots of easy ways to get started, and don't let anything hold you back, like the idea that you can't do it because your brain is too busy. I hear that all the time, and I like to tell people the good news and the bad news is you're not special. Everybody's mind is out of control, and meditation can work for anybody.
Dan, I wonder what the percent would be of people who have had panic attacks. I bet it's pretty darn high.
Oh, yeah, and anxiety is, from what I've read of late, more common these days than depression.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
yeah.
So these things are highly, highly prevalent, and the odds are that within your average life, a lot of people will experience panic, anxiety, or depression. And there are ways, I don't think, especially with panic, in the middle of a panic attack, you can't just throw yourself onto the ground and sit in the lotus position and meditate and everything's going to get better. What I do think, though, is that meditation is a great way. It's a great bit of preventive medicine. Just the same as like when you're having a heart attack, you can't start exercising in the middle of the heart attack to prevent the heart attack.
Yeah.
But if you exercise with some regularity, the odds of having a heart attack go down. And I think it's the same with meditation and depression, anxiety, and panic.
Let's go to Bill, Porter, Texas. Bill, let's squeeze you in. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I made it just under the wire.
Yay. You sure did.
my mind goes blank. Now I'm having a bit of a panic attack.
Oh, you have my fullest sympathy.
Yeah, I know. I used to be so good at public speaking. I gave my testimony in front of a mega church without any problem, 35 years ago, and I got up in front of a group of about 8 or 9 coworkers I was going to give a safety lecture and just completely went blank. And, anyway, that's not my question. That's not why I called. You were talking about visiting your psychiatrist, and when he heard that you were on drugs, it seemed like the investigation stopped. And I was just curious. I was thinking maybe, maybe your panic attack had something to do with that very traumatic experience of going over to a war zone. I'll take my answer off the air so I can listen to myself on the radio.
Okay.
That's an excellent, excellent question. And so let me put a little meat on the bone. The investigation didn't really stop because I went to see him for a long period of time and we went through lots and lots of issues. But I think he was right that the most likely proximate cause for the panic attack was this synthetic boost of adrenaline that I was giving myself through drugs. It was just like the most obvious thing. But as for the trauma of going to a war zone, I have to say that for me, while there was some trauma and I did see some horrible things and lose some friends, that the real damage to me was that I got addicted to the adrenaline of being there, and that's why I was doing the drugs, to kind of make up for the lost adrenaline when I came home. And so I don't think that I had classic PTSD. What I think I had was more like sort of an addiction to the thrill of it.
Well, you're right about that, and so many troops are coming back, Dan, with the PTSD. It's a very, very difficult situation, and it's got to be extremely stressful for them, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I don't know if you cut me off if we're running out of time, but I would just say two things about that. One is, I certainly would never compare myself to the troops, because I've been with our men and women overseas on the front lines, and what they have gone through is so much more intense than what I've gone through. And the second thing I'd say is that as I mentioned earlier, both the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Army are spending millions of dollars to research whether meditation can prevent and treat this epidemic of PTSD, and the results are very promising. And, it is entirely possible that you could see meditation become part of basic training.
So in this situation with you, 10% happier, and how you're able to turn this around and continue, what do you do next, Dan? I mean, what do you do to keep tuned up so it never happens again?
Well, I like to take the pressure off myself in some ways by saying it may happen again, but I'll just do my best to make sure it doesn't. So, I do everything possible to keep myself in good shape. You know, I exercise, I eat right, although I did have a sleeve of cookies earlier tonight. I try to meditate every day. I definitely meditate every day. I like to have good relationships with the people around me. So I'm just pressing every possible lever I can on the happiness front. And I think that's what all of us ought to do. And will bad things happen to me? Absolutely. Life, we live in a universe characterized by chaos and impermanence.
Indeed.
Where basically we're not in control. And so all you can be responsible for is how you respond to the things that are thrown your way, both good and bad. And that's what the training of meditation is. It's the training in resilience. And we all need it because there are no happy endings here.
Dan, my next trip into New York, I'll try to look you up, okay?
Please do. It's been a pleasure.
Dan Harris, the book, 10% Happier. And, of course, you can see him on ABC News. You can see him on Good Morning America on the weekends. You can see him on Nightline during the week. He's all over the place. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM.